Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Slash Filmcast. My name is David Chen, and they told me you couldn't make a movie about digging a hole in someone's backyard, but they were wrong. Joining me today is Devendra Hardawar.
I am not the asshole in this relationship.
And also Jeffrey Cannata.
It's pronounced Jafe.
Oh my God, Jeff.
Did you get it?
That was awful.
You get it, right?
Okay, that was pretty good.
Yeah, that's really good. Come on.
Is that the first time you've done that?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. I mean, bravo, Jeff. Bravo.
Because you know the guy in the movie we're talking about.
Yeah, I know. The guy we're in the movie, right? What's his name again in the movie?
Ralph, right?
Yeah. Ralph, right?
Ralph Fiennes.
Well, you really crack yourself up, Jeff.
I do.
You really crack yourself up.
Must have had this one loaded for a while. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you had
waiting for that refined tip.
He's waiting. Yeah.
Dude, I thought of that 2 seconds before we started.
Okay, I have to explain. You know, I ask everyone, you know, we've been doing these like little person intros, and right before we record, I said, "You guys have your intro ready?" And Jeff said, "Yes, I do." And then he started laughing maniacally for about three whole minutes.
I said, "No, I don't. Give me a second. I'll come up with one." And then I started giggling.
It's true.
Yeah.
Anyway.
It wasn't like years in the making. I just. That's good. That's real good. Come on.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Welcome to the Slash Filmcast. You can find more episodes of this podcast. If you haven't tuned out already, you can find more episodes of this podcast at slashfilmcast.com. Email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Today, we got some What We've Been Watching, which is going to include a spoiler-filled discussion of WandaVision. And then we got some weekly plugs followed by a featured review of The Dig, the new film that's out right now on Netflix, starring Carey Mulligan and Ralph Fiennes. In the After Dark this week, which is available exclusively for patrons at patreon.com/filmpodcast, an in-depth discussion of Malcolm and Marie, also on Netflix this week. Actually really excited about that conversation. I think that'll be a really fun one.
Let's just spend the entire time shouting at each other.
Yeah, it's going to be 2 hours of yelling at each other, or as we like to call it, an episode of the Slash Filmcast.
Nailed it, Jeff. Okay, but before we get to that, just a brief, more serious note. Christopher Plummer passed away this week, which is really, really sad. This guy is a legendary actor, and I wanted to just take a minute to acknowledge his career, which has over 200 credits. I mean,
Incredible. In recent years,
this guy has become a legend for two reasons alone. Like, even if he didn't have another, like the rest of his career, for two reasons alone. First of all, he was in Knives Out. He played Harlan Thrombey, the Rian Johnson movie, and I thought he did an incredible job in that film.
Incredible. So, yes.
Gave a lot of gravitas and pathos to that. Not really a spoiler. He's the murder victim in that movie.
Somebody gets murdered in the murder mystery.
Someone gets murdered and it's him. And I thought he did a fantastic job. But also, does everyone remember when they had to reshoot? They had to excise Kevin Spacey from Ridley Scott's All the Money in the World.
That movie doesn't exist. About three weeks
before that movie was released into theaters, and Christopher Plummer was like, "I'll do it. I'll do it." And he just
actor. That's a working actor. They're like, talk about this guy has theater background, right? He was an understudy in a film, you know? That doesn't happen very often.
He was in an understudy in a film, and he didn't even know it. You know what I mean? Like, he didn't know that he was going to be. But, I mean, that's just like straight up gangster, man. Like, that's just incredible that he was able to step in and
total baller, man.
And make that movie something into a thing that was releasable, right? Like, if he hadn't done that, then all the hundreds of people who worked on that film, like, that might have never seen the light of day. Bravo to him and for inspiring many memes about him stepping in and replacing actors at the last minute who have been canceled. But I want to ask you guys, like, are there any other Christopher Plummer performances that you're particularly fond of? A couple come to mind for
me.
So
many.
Mm-hmm. I'll just share like kind of my favorites. Obviously, Von Trapp in The Sound of Music. Like, that's a movie that I watched so many times as a kid. My mom really indoctrinated us into the ways of The Sound of Music when we were little. Mike Wallace in The Insider.
He did a
great Mike Wallace impression. And dude, The Insider is a fantastic movie. Yeah,
Dave, I know you got to go with Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, right?
The thing is, he is actually really good in that movie.
But it
does weird me out that he is called General Chang. In the movie, which is kind of like an Asian name, and I'm not sure if like the Klingons are supposed to be coded as Asian. And I don't know if you know this, but despite his ability to change into Kevin Spacey, he is not Asian. So,
well, I did spend much of my childhood wondering how the hell that eye patch was attached to his face.
Drilled
into his skull, evidently, is what we were led to believe in that movie.
I'm going to say that Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, was one of my first exposures to Shakespeare, because that movie came out in, 1991 was when Star Trek VI came out, so I was quite a youngin' at the time, and there is this, if you haven't seen Star Trek VI, A, it's a great film, B, there is a moment that is totally badass when, spoiler alert for Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, if I recall correctly, somebody shoots a torpedo at his Klingon warbird, and he starts quoting Hamlet, right?
Yeah.
He starts saying, to be or not to be, that is the question. And then this torpedo like slams into his ship, and it's like, holy shit, that's a badass way to go out.
Yeah. Whole title of the movie is a Shakespeare quote, but yes.
Yes, that is correct. Also Hamlet, Jeff.
Also Hamlet.
Don't question my Shakespeare bona fides. But he was awesome in that. And another movie I remember him from is Dr. Goines in 12 Monkeys. He's Brad Pitt's father in that film. And I always felt bad because I felt like he was a kind of accomplished dude that had to deal with Brad Pitt in that movie for a son. So that just felt like it must have been challenging. Anyway, those are a few of my favorite Christopher Plummer performances. You guys have anything that comes to mind?
I think you brought up the ones I probably would jump to, is because I watched 12 Monkeys quite a bit as a teenager, and he just seemed like towering that role. And then as I learned to love Michael Mann movies, The Insider, the fact that, you know, he did a pretty compelling Mike Wallace, or a very true to life Mike Wallace. So I really appreciated that the more I watched that movie.
Jeffrey, as a lover of theater and acting, like what are your favorite Mike? I was going to say Mike Wallace, favorite Christopher Plummer performances.
Have you guys seen Barrymore?
No.
He plays John Barrymore, and I guess he did that a lot. He played John Barrymore quite a few times. I think there's a stage version, and I think he did like a TV movie version where he played, not a version of the same thing, but like playing John Barrymore in other things. But it's awesome. And yeah, he was incredible. And, six decades of career in film and the theater. It's, that's quite an accomplishment in and of itself. Really, long life. And one of those people where, you know, he passed away and you go, he lived a long, full life. So it's not as if he was, you know, always you think taken too mm-hmm. soon, but at least, you know, we got to see a lot of this very talented man.
Yeah. Well, Christopher Plummer, rest in peace. You were a badass until the very end. And, his contributions to the world of cinema are indelible, and we really appreciate them. But great call, Jeff. Barrymore, very well reviewed, not a movie I've seen. So appreciate you shouting that one out.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's get to what we've been watching. Let's do a couple things before we dive into WandaVision, because the WandaVision conversation is going to be a while. So why don't we make that our second segment? I'll shout out a couple things I've been watching real quick. First of all, I had a chance to see Blown Away Season 2. Do you guys know what the show Blown Away is on Netflix?
Mm-mm. Yes. It is not the like a TV version of the... I used to think it was like
film?
Blowout. No, it was like a Blowout. I was like, did they turn that into a TV series? What's happening here? But no, it's about
It is not a TV show version of the Stephen Hopkins 1994 thriller starring Tommy Lee Jones and Jeff Bridges,
yes,
correct?
Yes.
Yeah, that is Jeff Bridges. Yeah.
It is
the bomb makers, right?
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
This is instead a reality show about glass blowing.
Oh, I watched one episode of this.
Yeah,
a long time ago after I'd eaten a very special cookie.
Wow. Jeff. And I'll just say a couple quick things about Blown Away, which are that I think the show is quite enjoyable. It feels like a reality show that has almost no budget. I mean, and what I mean by that is the dialogue on the show is painfully generic, right? So I don't know if you guys like, do you guys have any favorite reality shows? Like, what are some of the reality shows you actually enjoy? Just out of curiosity. I'll say like Top Chef is one that I am, sure, am fond, yeah, of.
I've mentioned a number of design shows that my wife and I are both into, like Grand Designs and,
right.
You know, those, I like, you know, there's a lot of, you know, HGTV, yeah, that we watch and that kind of
but
thing.
But you're talking more like the competition ones, right? So that would be Top Chef territory and stuff.
Top, yeah, Chef, you know, Great British Baking Show, like those kind of things. But this feels like it has like a quarter of the budget of those shows. Because like, first of all, all the stuff takes place in one location. And secondly, like the dialogue is so generic, like, and because it's the world of glassblowing, which is not a particularly well-known one, you have people who are guests on the show that most people don't know who they are, right? Like, it's like, this week we have so-and-so who studied at the glass school of blah, blah, blah. And it's like, you've never heard of that person. Cut away to an interview where someone says, oh my gosh, I'm so glad we have so-and-so because they're really good at judging things. You know, it's like, it's just the most generic dialogue ever. But what is cool about this show is you get to see some really cool glass creations that these people make. I don't even watch the whole show, guys. I just watch the first 3 minutes where they say, here's what the challenge is. And then I skip to the last 10 minutes where they evaluate what the people have created. And if you do that, you can like pound through the entire season in like less than 2 hours.
You just missed the whole process. The act of blowing. Come on.
It's so true. It's so true. Yeah. They have all these things that like would make Jeff giggle, I think. Like they use like glory holes to make the glass
now
creations.
You're just making things up. Come
and,
on.
You're saying that people blow something with a glory hole?
It's true. And then at the end every week they award a best in blow to one of the contestants. So
I mean, you know, if your category is blowing, right, you really just gotta lean into all the double entendres and everything, right? Like just really go for it.
You gotta. So Blown Away season 2 is something I've been watching this week, and I would recommend it. It's quite enjoyable, and I'd also recommend you watch it the way I watch it. But you know, if you want to watch the whole thing, that's fine too. Also, Blown Away season 2 has something that I never thought I would see in a show about glass blowing, which is it has a villain played by someone named Chris Taylor. In the show,
any good reality show has a villain. Let me just say this: you want to hate somebody, at least one person.
It's true. I just never thought that I would feel strongly enough about glass blowing in my whole life to hate someone who's doing it. But Chris Taylor in this show, he's a guy that every week he disregards the brief. Do you know what I'm saying? Like people are like, "Hey, make a sculpture about make a sculpture that's looks like a cartoon character." That's like what they ask everyone to do. And then he'll say at the end of the episode, I decided to go a different direction with the brief. Mine is about free speech. Like, and that's literally what he's, and you'd think, oh, well, of course he's going to get eliminated immediately, but that's not what happens. He keeps going week after week and it's absolutely infuriating. And if you actually search on Twitter for Chris Taylor Blown Away, you'll see just endless amounts of hate for this guy. Some of it's not undeserved.
Keeps you watching though, right? You gotta have that villain to make sure you see what they're up to this week.
You know, it's actually true. It really did keep me watching to see if Chris Taylor would meet his downfall, and I'm not gonna say whether or not he did, but if you want to find out, check out Blown Away season 2. It's on Netflix right now. I had a chance to watch a show called City So Real. Have you guys heard of this? This is a new documentary series by Steve James. Mm-hmm. And it is available right now on Hulu. And it basically is an almost impressionistic documentary about the city of Chicago and specifically their most recent mayoral race. Basically, Rahm Emanuel was the mayor of Chicago. I don't know if you guys know that. And he said, hey, I'm not running because of a terrible incident in which a black man was shot to death by police, and the handling of that, he was excoriated for that, and so he's like, I'm not. He realized he had lost the support of the black community. He couldn't win without it, so he's like, I'm not going to run again. And that left an opening for over a dozen people to jump into the mayoral race, some of whom were really unconventional and who you wouldn't expect. And this documentary, City So Real, chronicles that race and also looks at the rest of Chicago. And what emerges from this show is a portrait of a quintessential American city. You kind of get a sense of everything that people in the city are struggling with. You get a glimpse of people who are living in high society. You get a glimpse of people who are living in poverty and struggling to survive. You really get a sense of it all through this 5-part documentary. I found it to be very powerful, moving, and also insightful about what it's like to be in an American city these days. Devendra, it felt like something you might enjoy, particularly as somebody who used to live in the quintessential American city, you know,
the
New York
City. Yeah.
Yeah. But
used to live, don't rub it in. Okay. Still hurts.
But I thought this is a tremendous piece of work, and it's available right now on Hulu. People can just go watch it right now. But and if you don't want spoilers for real life, don't look up who the mayor of Chicago is right now, because the documentary kind of hinges on that decision point. But it's really incredible. The only other thing I'll shout out is that it shows how the system is designed to keep out new entrants. Do you guys see Knock Down the House on Netflix, the AOC documentary?
Yeah.
Which is also awesome. Like, and you see how challenging it was for her to get on the ballot and her to run. And it's really a system that's designed to keep out newcomers. And
she was running against a guy who didn't even live in New York and who didn't show up to like anything. It was ridiculous. Absolutely.
Yeah. So there's like a very similar dynamic plays out when you see how difficult it is for these people to actually have any kind of chance at even getting onto the ballot, let alone winning. And so it's also kind of a stark reminder of how much work we have to do to make politics more accessible and more engaging to everyone. So I really enjoyed it. It's City So Real. It's the new Steve James documentary that's on Hulu right now. Finally, before we get to WandaVision, I want to ask about Malcolm and Marie. So we are going to talk about Malcolm and Marie, full spoilers in the After Dark. I want each of you to give me a one sentence or less review of Malcolm and Marie. Should people watch it? Jeff Cannata?
Absolutely, you should watch it. Yeah, I found it fascinating on a number of levels. I think it's a really interesting, challenging movie that makes you think, and well worth your time to watch, for sure.
Devendra Hardwar?
Yeah, I definitely think it's worth watching. Perhaps not executed in the best way, I'd say, but as I tweeted, it does feel like a Reddit Am I the Asshole thread in movie form. Like, that's it. That's the movie. And if you enjoy those things, you'll probably dig this.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say Malcolm and Marie is a colossal waste of time for everyone involved, including everyone who's watching it. And I look forward to talking with you guys about it. But it is worth watching to understand the memes online. That's
exactly
what I'll say.
Like, this is in conversation now, right?
So yeah, I think it's a fascinating movie. I think it's even if you end
also,
up coming away with it feeling it's a waste
people,
of...
It's your two people talking in a room movie, Jeff.
Yeah, man.
Like, it is your
that's
thing.
That's my jam. Yeah.
But also, the movie is bad. I'll just leave
it's
it at that.
It's not great. It's not a great movie, but, you know, we're talking about.
All right. So those are a few things that I've been watching this week. It's time to thank one of our sponsors, Paint Your Life. Folks, Valentine's Day is coming up, and if you want to do something special to celebrate it, what better idea than to get a special hand-painted portrait of you and a loved one? When I first heard about paintyourlife.com, I thought, what a great idea. This thing has got to be super-duper expensive. But the thing is, paintyourlife.com gives you professional hand-painted portraits created from any photo at a truly affordable price. You can choose from a team of world-class artists and work with them until every detail is perfect. I've used paintyourlife.com, and the platform is super easy to use. It lets you order a custom-made, hand-painted portrait in less than 5 minutes. You can get a hand-painted portrait in about 3 weeks or so, but the process to get it is so quick and easy. All you got to do is send any picture. It can be you and a family member, you and a loved one, a cherished pet, a special place. You can also combine photos into one painting. This thing makes a perfect birthday present, anniversary present, or wedding gift, but it's also important for Valentine's Day, and we all know we could use a good idea when it comes to Valentine's Day in general. That is coming up right quick. So check out Paint Your Life. And one other thing, at paintyourlife.com, there is no risk. If you don't love the final painting, your money is refunded guaranteed. And right now, as a limited time offer, get 20% off your painting. That's right, 20% off and free shipping. To get this special offer, text the word FILM to 64,000. That's FILM to 64,000. Text FILM to 64,000. Paint your life. Celebrate the moments that matter most. Terms apply. Available at paintyourlife.com/terms. Again, text FILM to 64,000. All right, folks. We got to talk about WandaVision Season 1, Episode 5. Now, in order to talk about this, we got to go into spoilers, right?
Yeah. Unprecedented territory of early spoilers in the first quarter of the show.
Yes. Yeah. So we are going to do a full WandaVision season review later on in the Slash Filmcast. But we got to go into full spoilers. And in order to make it a little bit easier for people to identify when the spoilers begin and end, I'm going to play a sound that's going to take us into the spoilers. And then I'm going to play a sound that's going to take us out. And it's basically, you know, the Marvel theme song that happens at the beginning of the show and of many Marvel movies. That's the song that I'm going to play to take us into spoilers. And then I took that audio and reversed it. And that's going to bring us out of the spoilers.
You made the Tenet version of the song.
I made the Tenet version of that song. So let's get into spoilers for WandaVision Season 1, Episode 5, starting right now. So WandaVision Season 1, Episode 5 was, I thought, already a fairly good episode. You know, I've been really enjoying the show. I've been appreciating how every week it pulls back a layer of what's going on. And just been loving the very meticulously constructed homages to classic sitcoms.
For sure. But also the return of Jimmy Woo. Come on. That is...
Yes, yes.
That's the reason to watch the show. The return of Captain
Also Darcy. Yeah, also Darcy. Yeah.
Love it.
The mix of meticulously constructed 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s sitcoms, in the case of this week, like Family Ties and Growing Pains and things like that, combined with just abject psychological horror. Right. This idea of, wow, like these people are under, not only are these people under psychic control, but they apparently are in agony. Right. Like that's kind of what is indicated this week.
Yeah. When Vision, deep down, they're aware of it. And yeah. It's terrifying. Yeah.
When Vision forces that guy out of his mind control and he's like, oh, my God, like I got to call my sister. She's taking care of my sick dad. I'm like, geez, this escalated quickly. Like, wow, this show is dark. And so I'm like, OK, I'm already a huge fan of what the show is doing. I'm enjoying finding out a little bit more every week.
I thought you were not into it at first. I thought the first conversation...
The first two episodes, I was not into it. But then episode three,
Zero patience and trust.
Well, let's just say I've been burned too many times before, Jeff. Okay?
We've been burned quite a bit.
Yes. Yeah. But then episode three really started pulling back the curtain, and episode four basically tore the curtain off.
Let me just say before we get there, do you not agree that it made episode 4 and 5 better that we slow burned our way into them? Like,
no,
the fact that the idea that this show slowly reveals itself as being two things at the same time, and that you've got this like movie quality section of the show that starts to impede more and more on the television side. If it had just been that from the outset, it would not feel nearly as special.
But I don't feel like, come on, we know how this, like, we kind of know how this works, and we kind of have a sense of where Wanda was post Endgame and everything, right? So I was just waiting for that reveal, right? I was seeing people shocked. Oh my God, WandaVision actually connects into the MCU. Guys, we had 23 movies where they set up this entire universe and everything is interconnected. And, you know, I was waiting for that moment. For me, I didn't mind the slow burn. I just didn't, I don't think I liked the 50s sitcom motif as much as other people did. So just sitting through that for two episodes was, that just felt grating because we didn't have more to dive into. But yeah, the show transformed with episode 3 and even more with episode 4. So yeah, it grew.
Here's what I will say, Jeff. I will say that what is great about the meticulously constructed, you know, homages is that when they snap out of those homages, it is, I find it truly unsettling when it happens.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I would not feel that way if they hadn't been so meticulously constructed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know? And I will because they play it
so straight, like the camera style, you know, the photography style and the sort lighting
of,
and the,
sort
you know,
of
the sets.
They create sets that are supposed to be, you know, like multi-camera shows. Right.
Yes.
And they take some liberties where they just shoot it from the front. Right.
They take some liberties, but in general, I'm pretty impressed with how well they recreate it. And then whenever they snap out of that, it's always terrifying to me.
Yeah. It's too many cooks. It turns into too many cooks of like, oh, you are destroying the artifice of the sitcom, and this is kind of hilarious.
Yeah, yeah, you're talking about the viral Adult Swim viral video that went live a few years ago. But yeah, sorry, go ahead, Jeff.
No, I was just going to say that this show and this Phase 4, way that Marvel's kicking off Phase 4, makes me even more retroactively pissed off at the Star Wars episodes
because that's of how in control they are of the storytelling. Basically,
we have to move on, Jeff. How
planned out, how much forethought, how much respect they're giving to each aspect, how things their setups and payoffs that clearly required a lot of macro level thinking.
Yep.
And it can be done. Look, it can be done across multiple properties, across multiple media types. It can be done. And it's so satisfying to see the chess pieces move. And then you get this wonderful payoff of something that was set up multiple movies beforehand. That is very exciting to me as a viewer because no one has ever really done that before. And the idea that, you know, you sit down and you're going to make 3 more Star Wars movies and no one thinks on that macro level.
Let's get to this show. Okay. So at the very end of the show, like Vision starts realizing something's going on. There's still many open questions about what is actually happening in this universe, right?
Because he should be dead. Yes.
Is Wanda just, you know, moving Vision's corpse around and like, is he actually dead? I think he is because we saw that little glimpse of him last week, a couple weeks ago. Who is actually controlling this? Is it just Wanda as Monica Rambeau seems to think? There's probably some other force at play. What is Agnes's true role in this? Like, there's all these other questions about what's actually going on in this town. Where are the children? You know, what's the deal with Wanda's children? Because they seem to be actual kids as opposed to people under control. So
also the literal plot of M. Night Shyamalan's upcoming movie, Old. It's just the kids grow fast.
Nailed it.
It's kind of hilarious.
I bet M. Night felt really red in the face when he saw WandaVision this week. So, okay. So all those are still open questions. But then at the very end, Vision's about to realize what's happening. He's like confronting Wanda and the doorbell rings and Wanda opens the door. And it is literally the last person that I would have ever expected to see at that door, which is.
But the coolest person you could possibly see at that door.
It's her brother, Pietro, a.k.a. Quicksilver. But as we all know, Quicksilver was killed by Ultron in the Avengers Age of Ultron. It is not Aaron Taylor Johnston who played Quicksilver in that film. It is instead Evan Peters who played Quicksilver in the Bryan Singer era X-Men films.
Specifically,
amazing.
X-Men Days of Future Past.
Yeah.
Which was absolutely stunning. It sends your mind reeling. And then we hear Darcy say, oh my gosh, she recast Pietro? Question mark. Now, this could be just, hey, here's a little fun Easter egg. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know,
it ain't.
Or it could be the thing that cracks open the entire MCU multiverse and introduces us to the idea of the X-Men being in the MCU.
Yep.
Yeah.
By the way, we even touched on this a little. Like, this show could be the thing that opens the gateway for the X-Men. And this is why I'm excited, because I always loved Evan Peters in those movies. And Evan Peters, by the way, became this great, like, go-to TV actor. Ryan Murphy has used him a ton across all of his shows, and dude is super talented. So I'm excited to see where this goes.
Jeff, what was your reaction? Tell me about your thought process when you saw Evan Peters.
I believe you tweeted it, in fact. So your mind reels immediately because of the ramifications of what this could mean. Now, we know that Disney has acquired Fox and the rights to all of the X-Men characters. We anticipate that these characters are going to be folded in to the overall Marvel strategy in some way. If they're going to be actually brought into the MCU proper, then one imagines that this is that first step. Now, the last time we talked about WandaVision originally, about it sort of being an inverted telling of House of M, which is a Brian Michael Bendis crossover series from several years ago, where that really focuses on Wanda Maximoff, on Scarlet Witch, and she is in the center role. The plot of that crossover is Wanda is so distraught about her twin children being taken from her that she refolds space and time, reality itself, and says no more mutants. And all of the mutants lose their powers because she is that powerful herself.
Wow.
Now, you know, so clearly we're in that wheelhouse. You know, we've got the twins. We've got her kind of obsessing about them, freaking out, not understanding what's going on with them. Those twins the thing that is so fun for a comic book fan is you don't know right now. I don't know how deep Marvel's going, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. How much they're bringing in, because those two kids in the comics grow up to be founding members of the Young Avengers. They are very important characters in and of themselves. The House of M, right? We talked about maybe it being an inverted version of that, where instead she says no more mutants. Now maybe this is how we get mutants in some way. We also know the next phase that we're about to embark on here with the Doctor Strange film and the next Spider-Man film are all about Kang and the multiverse. So if you think that Marvel's maybe working on this idea that maybe Wanda is plucking versions of characters from another reality, another strain of the universe, another timeline, and if Marvel is going to somehow unify the entire Fox timeline of X-Men films with the Marvel timeline and have them be two divergent realities that are now crossing over. We know the Spider-Man film is going to do some of that with other versions of Spider-Man movies. It is as ambitious as Thanos and the Infinity War and the Infinity Gems and all of that. This seems even more bonkers,
yes,
and more wildly ambitious. And then one thinks, okay, well, if they pull that off, if that's the end game, quote unquote, end game of Phase 4, then Phase 5 is definitely going to be X-Men versus Avengers, which was another huge crossover event. Why not have X-Men versus Avengers? I mean, that feels so exciting and wild and something to look forward to. And there are tons of clues, and there's so much in this show already. I mean, we have another Captain Marvel potentially in this show. Monica Rambeau is Captain Marvel in the comics, right? We saw her as a child in the 90s in the first Captain Marvel movie. And now here she is here with the same haircut as the comic book version of Captain Marvel. Radiated by cosmic energy. She's talking about cosmic rays, which are what created the Fantastic Four. You know, it's like everything is all happening.
Yeah.
Calm down. Oh, man.
Yeah, the Fantastic Four, the idea, because Monica Rambeau makes oblique reference to, like, who should we get that really is good at astrophysics or something like that? And it's like, I know one.
Yeah, I know someone who's good at astrophysics. We're talking about cosmic rays. She keeps saying cosmic rays this, cosmic rays that. Cosmic rays is what, you know, the Fantastic Four were pelted with to turn them into superheroes. It just feels like it's all this next tier of superheroes is all going to be flowing out of this crazy wacky show on the Disney Plus.
Can you imagine if this is the show that is going to bring together MCU, X-Men, and Fantastic Four together into one?
I think it's a much longer play than that. I think this is the first domino of what will eventually get there. But I mean, basically we're already seeing it, right? We just watched Quicksilver from the X-Men movies walk into Scarlet Witch from the Marvel movies, like that and Vision, you know, that has happened already. So we're already there.
Yeah. So a few reactions to all that's going on. First of all, a few weeks ago, Kevin Feige was asked, when are the X-Men going to be integrated into the MCU? And he basically says, like, it's still, like, quite a ways off, right? Which is just god-tier trolling, in my opinion, because he knew that this was going to happen. And so just a few weeks ago, he's like, yeah, it's still on the way. It's not coming yet. In 2019, when he gave an interview, he said it's still a long while away, is what he said. So I just love that he's just kind of not showing his hand, plays the cards really close to the vest. I enjoy that. Second thing is, I love how you put it, Jeff, this idea that introducing superhero characters and then bringing them all together into these major event films like Avengers and Endgame and so on, that's a big deal. But what could possibly top that, right?
Right, is the question. Exactly.
And the answer to that question may be introducing superheroes from other universes, right? Like from whole other sets of films, like
to sort of retroactively, turn the last 30 years of movies across multiple companies into one cohesive story.
It's just like, what?
So Ready Player One was right, guys. Ready Player One had it right all along. Yeah.
it's just like to even contemplate how ambitious it is, my mind is reeling. Also, at the same time, I want to temper my expectations because I do think it is possible that, hey, it's just a little fun casting Easter
egg. Yeah, it could be. But it's
exciting. It's exciting that they're releasing it week to week, and we don't know.
Three fucking Star Wars movies to make sense together, please. Sorry. I won't stop going back to that.
It's exciting that we don't know. Like, this is, as we're recording this right now, we don't know. We're probably going to find out this week whether or not Evan Peters is supposed to be that Quicksilver. But it's just fun to be in this kind of liminal space where we don't know what is actually going to happen with this thing. And I enjoy the fact that they're releasing it week to week. Gives us stuff to talk about and think about. So, Devendra, any other thoughts on this week's episode of WandaVision, Season 1, Episode 5?
No, I think we pretty much covered it. It's exciting because, as I've talked about, like, I'm a huge X-Men fan as well. I'm a bigger X-Men fan than I am of the Avengers, right? So those movies meant a lot to me. And to see where they went down and how far they've fallen and what they did with Apocalypse and Dark Phoenix, like, yeah, it needs a reboot. I hope they do these characters justice. I'm just not ready for a new Wolverine. I don't think my heart is ready for that yet.
Jeff, have you heard about the casting news for the new Spider-Man movie? Like,
unfortunately, I would rather have been surprised by that. I mean, can you imagine how mind-blowing that would be if it just happened
in
the context of watching the movie?
When the casting news broke, I'm like, it sounds weird and potentially dumb, right? Like what they're doing. But now, if what you're saying is correct about this introducing the multiverse, it all makes sense now. And it makes me super amped for Spider-Man 3, right? Like, I'm like, what is going to happen there?
Doctor Strange, right? I think Doctor Strange is going to, it's called something multiverse, right?
Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness.
Yeah.
By Sam Raimi. Come on. Let's get excited about that.
That movie is going to be bonkers too. I mean, if it's literally, he's the first guy like dancing between all these different realities, it's going to be, crazy and awesome. And this phase just seems so cool on so many levels. You know, they've already introduced time travel in the MCU, and this is what I loved when I was 12 years old with Marvel Comics. You know, is that I bought the Spider-Man book, and I bought mm-hmm. the Thor book, and I bought the Captain America book, and then every summer there was Secret Wars or something crazy where they all came together and all these crossovers, and the X-Men family of books did this. You know, Chris Claremont did it more and better than anybody. It was like all these different books were happening, and then every summer it was like this big, huge event. And like to do that on this scale with TV shows and movies and all these different properties, it's so awesome. And I know, you know, this is the only kind of content we get anymore, but at least they're doing it well. You know, at least it's exciting and fun.
It's exciting now, but it is also, you know, the thing we were worried about too, of like, there's just going to be one movie studio, you know, in the future.
Yeah, I know.
It's going to be all Disney. And as long as they give us the good drugs, you know, we'll be happy. But after a while, you know, you're mad at what they did to Star Wars. It's the same company. It's the same company who screwed up Star Wars is giving you all this good Marvel stuff. So that's I worry about Disney just becoming bigger and bigger and so powerful. I kind of wish they were still separate. Like, I would love to see the X-Men, you know, be rebooted in a world that didn't have to deal with the legacy of the MCU or anything. Maybe I just got a little tired of the MCU movies, so I want something fresh.
But yeah, say what you will about the X-Men cinematic universe, but we'd get genuinely unique creations like Logan, mm-hmm. and also to a lesser extent, New Mutants. You know what
Deadpool,
I mean?
But it was Deadpool's like, in there. Deadpool like made Deadpool, the R. You know, yeah, those are comic different movie a thing. Yeah.
If Fox was owned by Disney, you know, 10 years ago, Deadpool probably never would have happened, right? So it's just nice. It was nice when you had a movie studio that was a little bit more desperate and willing to take bigger swings with the property.
Competition is great. So. Competition is great. Competition for Sony to make that like deal with Marvel as well to kind of make Spider-Man happen. Like, it is, for me, conflict and competition is sort of the heart of creativity, you know? And when things get too easy, things get too big, it's like, oh yeah, we can make anything happen. We are, you know, the Mickey Mouse company. We can make our TV shows look like feature films, which we've seen time and again. The Mandalorian looks better than most science fiction films we see. I worry about like the struggle, us losing that struggle a bit.
Indeed. I don't disagree with you guys, but also if you're talking big swings, you have to say WandaVision is a big swing.
It's a big swing. But you know who did that first, and I think hit me even harder? Mr. M. Night Shyamalan with the end of Split. Come on. No,
believe me, I'm all for that. That was incredible. I don't think his payoff movie was that great, but you know, it was fine. It was fine.
But I agree. I'm really like Timothy Mabley in the chat room as we're broadcasting live says, like, the stakes of Phase 4's finale has got to be the fate of the entire multiverse, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. If the stakes of Phase 3 were the fate of the universe, this is going to be the fate of the multiverse, which I'm like, wow, okay, respect. That is the way you are taking up the stakes. Is it's not just our universe anymore. You're bringing others into it. I'm excited and looking forward to chatting with you guys about the entire show when it wraps up in a few weeks. So those are our thoughts on WandaVision Season 1, Episode 5.
That's pretty good.
Woo!
Yeah, love that. That was really good.
Do you guys feel it? We're not in spoilers.
I saw the flickering pages go by in my mind.
In reverse, though, right, Jeff?
In reverse. It's time for me to jump in here and tell you about our sponsor, HelloFresh. Oh my gosh, do I love HelloFresh? I use it every week. My wife and I love HelloFresh. Let me just pull up the app right now and check out what I've got coming up this week, arriving at my house. Cranberry Dijon pork tenderloin, Thai coconut curry chicken, and chicken sausage rigatoni napolitano. I mean, come on. HelloFresh is giving me fresh, pre-measured ingredients and mouth-watering seasonal recipes that are delivered right to my door. I get to pick out from over 23 recipes every week. It's such a delight to select the recipes I'm going to get every single week. I get variety in my menu. I get to cook fresh, home-cooked meals for my family. I get to be the one falling in love with cooking, but also providing for my family. It's amazing. They take away all the stress points of planning, of grocery store trips. I don't have to do any of that stuff. I can just enjoy the cooking and get dinner on the table in about 30 minutes or less. It's great. Eating healthier has never been easier. They have low-cal, carb-smart, vegetarian, pescatarian options every single week. And no matter what you choose, every single recipe is packed with fresh produce sourced directly from farmers. Cut down on the grocery bills. You can save up to 40% instead of shopping at your local store. HelloFresh delivers pre-portioned ingredients, so you're not overbuying. Stuff's not going bad in your fridge. It's a burden on the planet and your wallet. You're getting out of all of that. HelloFresh offers the flexibility you need with customizable orders every week. You can easily change your delivery days or food preferences or even skip a week whenever you need. It's great. I have been using HelloFresh for years now. We look forward to it every week. We build our entire menu of our weekly food consumption in this family around HelloFresh. So join us. Go to HelloFresh.com/FilmCast10 and use the code FilmCast10 for 10 free meals. 10 free meals, including free shipping. Again, HelloFresh.com/FilmCast10 and the promo code FilmCast10 will get you 10 free meals. HelloFresh.com/FilmCast10. Hey folks, it's time for me to jump in here and tell you about our sponsor, Quip. Quip. Oh, I love my Quip toothbrush. I love my Quip floss. But now, guess what? There's a third component. Gum. That's right, gum. Gum is the unsung hero when it comes to better oral health. The American Dental Association recommends chewing sugar-free gum for 20 minutes after meals. I love chewing gum, and now it's actually good for me. Gum is something people chew as a way to relieve stress, curb appetites, and most importantly, freshen your breath. But many people don't realize that gum can also be an integral part of a healthy oral care routine. Quip gum. Yeah, that's right. Quip has made gum. They've reinvented gum like they reinvented the toothbrush. Quip gum can help prevent cavities and freshen breath when chewed for 20 minutes after eating. It's sugar-free. It has tooth-friendly xylitol with zero calories. And to satisfy your taste buds, Quip added a long-lasting mint flavor, crunchy, tri-layered design, and stamped it all with the classic Quip tongue. That's pretty great. It's got a slick, travel-ready dispenser. It's really slim. It's nice. Comes in 5 different colors, metal or plastic. I have one of these things. It's so cool. It looks like the future. Doesn't look like obnoxious paper gum packs. It protects up to 10 gum pieces at a time, and it fits just about any purse or pocket for your on-the-go needs. And right now, we all need to be extra safe and hygienic, so their quick-release button means you can still share with your friends. No wrappers, no hands, no hassles. This is not a substitute for brushing or flossing, but this is a great support for your oral health. Pair it with the Quip electric toothbrush for adults and kids, the refillable floss, and more great products. You'll be on top of your oral hygiene game. In addition to gum packs, Quip also delivers fresh brush head, floss, and toothpaste refills every 3 months from $5. Shipping is free, so you can save money and skip the misery of in-store shopping. So join the over 5 million mouths already using Quip. Get chewing for less than $2 per gum pack. And if you go to getquip.com/filmcast right now, you can get a free plastic dispenser with any refill plan. That's a free dispenser at getquip.com/filmcast, spelled GETQUIP.com/FILMCAST. Quip, the good habits company.
All right, let's move on to what else we watched this week. Jeff Cannata, hit us with what you've been watching.
I checked out a show I think Devendra mentioned on the show before.
The first season of Search Party. Yeah.
Search Party. I am halfway through season 2. Boy, I dig this show. We basically, my wife and I binged a season and a half in like 2 days.
It's really good. Yeah,
it is really good. This feels like a show more people should be talking about. It's on HBO Max now, but I don't think it did it start its life there. It started somewhere else, right?
It was on HBO.
Because it's structured Showtime to have commercial breaks. And
I'm pretty sure it was on TBS originally.
TBS, yeah. Yes.
And then
yes,
HBO, yes. Max, yeah. HBO Max acquired it and made it an HBO Max original.
So, yeah, it's definitely structured to have commercial breaks. And you feel the excising of those commercials because it'll have a jump cut at a certain point. Where it's like, oh, that's where a commercial went. But this show is about a group of folks. There is a girl who goes missing, and they all went to college with her. Didn't really know her. Didn't really have much of a connection to her. But the fact that she goes missing, one of the main character in the show gets kind of obsessed with that fact. Even though she doesn't have any real connection to this woman, she wants to figure out what happened. And then it's I think in episode one, she sees the girl alive somewhere. So it's all about kind of figuring out what happened. But the show is much more than that. It's a half hour comedy in the sort of single cam wacky half hour comedy style that we know well in, you know, the Parks and Rec. And I mean, not there's no talking to camera, but that's kind of like a sitcom where it can be goofy and over the top. But also at the same time, the show handles the emotional truth of what's going on, the actual inner life of all these characters in a raw, dark, and very interesting way. So it's almost like this, you know, hour-long HBO or Netflix drama trapped inside a 22-minute sitcom. And the way those two tones play against each other is fascinating. It's really, really cool. I'm laughing and giggling at certain, you know, goofy situational moments or characters that behave in very exaggerated sitcom-y ways. And then also there's like scenes of trauma and you know, heart-wrenching kind of going through these deep moments, and you feel for a lot of characters, and there's a lot of very, very dark subject matter. There's, you know, there's it kind of goes through the fallout. What would it be like if you murdered someone, or you cheated on someone?
Oh, yeah, that does happen, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. I've always thought about what I'd feel like if I murdered someone. So, yeah.
Well, no, I mean,
the
like
classic mistake,
but no. So maybe you're not understanding what I'm saying, or maybe I'm not being clear about it. The idea is like in a sitcom, there's like the wacky or not sitcom, but maybe a broad comedy. You know, there's the moment where the person dies and you shove them in the closet and oh my God, their foot pops out and you know, that kind of wacky, like death as a punchline. And this show does that, but then also later is like, oh my God, we killed someone. You know, like what's that about?
Really dropping a major spoiler into this conversation, Jeff, because
I guess that's
true.
The show does not
start out. I mean, we can. I feel like it's been several years at this point. So it's like,
yeah, I was like, wait, someone dies in this? Thanks, Jeff.
I think, but this show does go somewhere. Like I gave up in the middle of season two, I think, just because when this show was running, guys, like it started in 2016. I was drowning in shows about like 20 something hipsters in New York. There were so many shows about that. So I think now is time for me to like go back and get into it, and it's certainly going to make me miss New York as well. But yeah, I'm glad you're digging it, Jeff. I'm looking forward to catching up.
Yeah, I really like it. I think the performances are all really strong, and the characters
Alia Shawkat, it's great.
Yeah, she's great. I think the characters are all fun and funny and. You know, I dig it. Search Party. Check it out. I like it a lot.
All right. That's Search Party. It's on HBO Max. Devinder Hardwar hit us with a couple things he's been watching.
Couple things real quick. I have seen Earwig and the Witch, which is the Goro Miyazaki movie that is, I believe, exclusive to HBO Max. And
yes.
So let me say up front, I hate this movie. I think I absolutely hate this movie.
Wow.
This is Studio Ghibli's very first CG animated movie. And it looks like trash. It just looks like complete garbage. And it could just be because I'm in a weird place, because in my life, Ghibli is playing like, 24/7 basically. Like, I'm always there, and I've seen all the, like, at least the kid-friendly ones dozens of times, probably hundreds of times by this point, because my daughter's obsessed, and I want her to see the good stuff. You know, she likes the good things and not like the random like YouTube cartoon. So I'm down with that, and I'm happy to like give her some screen time with that. But yeah, this movie, it's about a girl who is orphaned at the beginning, and she grows up to, I guess she's sort of like a witch, and she gets adopted by these people who also have magic powers. She gets adopted by a witch, and that is it. That's the movie. And I don't think, I think this movie just doesn't have anything that makes Ghibli movies typically good. Like, the characters are kind of awful. The lead character, Earwig herself, she's just kind of an annoying little brat who uses her magic to control people around her. And I was just never really with her as I would be in like a typical, like a Ghibli heroine or something. So I don't like them. I don't like her. I don't like the surrounding characters. There's nothing really funny or interesting happening in this movie. It is adapted by a Diana Wynne Jones from a Diana Wynne Jones novel. And Miyazaki did that before with Howl's Moving Castle. But I don't think this is a particularly great source material compared to like how rich and interesting houses. Like, this movie is pretty straightforward and simple. But yeah, the ultimate sin is that it looks like garbage. It looks like cheap CG animation. Maybe they were constrained by like TV movie budgets in a way. Like, this was not a movie meant to be theatrically released, but the characters are stiff. The facial animations have no detail or nuance. The backgrounds are sometimes interesting to look at, but there's no life to it. And the thing about Ghibli movies is that they're gorgeous to look at. There is immense levels of detail in so many things. I've been rewatching Ponyo on the Cliff quite a bit. Miyazaki hand drew the waves and the water in that movie, and you can tell just by watching it. And this movie just feels like, yeah, it was created by a machine to mimic what Ghibli does and doesn't do it very well. So yeah, stay away from this movie. I hate it.
Wow. On Rotten Tomatoes, this film has a 31%.
That's fair. Yeah.
And the critics' consensus is, quote, "With a story as uninspired as its animation, Earwig and the Witch is a surprising and near total misfire for Studio Ghibli," end quote. So looks like other critics agree with you on this one, Devendra, and I'm sorry.
Yeah, I also have to say, poor Gorō Miyazaki, who, if you've seen the documentaries I've talked about, like, I forget the name of that exact documentary, but there is one,
Kingdom of Dreams and Madness.
Kingdom of Dreams and Madness, yes, where you see the relationship between him and his father, and it is so interesting. Like, somebody's going to make like a dramatized version of that story at some point, because you have Hayao Miyazaki, a genius, a talent, an industry legend. And he is somebody, despite making these really like, friendly movies and movies that are really hopeful and about inspiring the next generation, he kind of hates people. He's kind of a misanthrope. Like, he has no hope really for adults or the state of the world. Like, he puts all his hope into kids, and that's how he channels his art, to make movies for kids. But yeah, he does not treat Gorō very well, and Goro's like always just underneath the shadow of his father. It is very much it's sort of like the Jiro Dreams of Sushi situation too, where like, no matter how good you are, you cannot match up to your legendary father. So, you know, it's a shame to see. Like, I think Tales from Earthsea, that was Goro's first movie that was based on the Ursula K. Le Guin novel, also not like super inspired. You know, it wasn't terrible, but it wasn't a Hayao Miyazaki movie, and you could tell.
I'm just going to give this random observation. I spent, I would say, a good 18 seconds convinced that Earwig and the Witch was somehow in the same cinematic universe
as
Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
Yep. I'm also making that mistake mentally. It's very different. Yeah,
it's a very, very different movie, first of all, than Earwig and the Witch. But the thing that, first of all, they have the same kind of title structure of like Earwig and the Witch, yeah. Hedwig and the
They're
Angry.
They're also both about rock and roll in a weird way. Like, rock and roll plays wig. A key thing.
They both have wig in the title.
They do.
They both have words that rhyme with witch, kind of. And the cover of both films is a character grabbing a microphone and like screaming into it.
It is rock and roll. It is. I wish it had some of the Hedwig energy because this movie is just lifeless. Have I told you guys about my experience seeing Hedwig in person, by the way?
No.
No.
I don't think I've mentioned this, but I got my wife almost front row tickets. It was like second row tickets. It was when Michael C. Hall was playing Hedwig, right? And
so that's the theatrical production of Hedwig in the end.
Yes, the Broadway. It was on Broadway. Yeah. Took my wife to see it. She was very like excited. And we love Michael C. Hall, you know? So I'd be down with that. That's a very bombastic role. That's a role in which Hedwig often gets out into the audience and like will grind on people and will like just jump all over people. So at some point during that that performance, Michael C. Hall jumped on top of the guy that was sitting right in front of me and just started like gyrating his crotch in that guy's face. So I'm sitting right behind this guy. So I think at one point, like I was just like my own face was like a foot away from Michael C. Hall's crotch. That's my Hedwig story. Good night, everybody.
I mean, it sounds like you got great value for your money. Yeah,
that's what I wanted. Yeah,
congratulations.
Earwig and the witch sounds like the Transmorphers to Transformers.
Yep.
Right?
It's the Transmorphers version of Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
It's like he's very much Transmorphers Ghibli. Like, yeah.
Straight to DVD. Like, our entire marketing strategy is that we're going to fool grandma and she's going to accidentally get this one for the kids.
It's by a Miyazaki, you know.
Somebody's looking for Hedwig and the Angry Inch. They turn this on instead.
That's their
marketing strategy.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Okay. Don't watch that movie. It's on HBO Max.
Don't watch that movie.
Devendra Harder, what else have you been watching?
Briefly, I just wanted to talk about Coda, which is the Sundance award-winning film. That was the one that also, I believe, Apple bought for $25 million, the biggest purchase ever at Sundance. And I saw it on the last day of the show. It is probably the most crowd-pleasing thing I've seen at Sundance this year. It is about a child of deaf adults. And it's basically a high school story because it's about this girl named Ruby who is going through high school, kind of an outcast because her family are it's a fisherman family, you know, in one of the coastal towns outside of Boston. And but her family's also deaf and she's the only hearing one in her family. So she ends up playing this role where she has to, you know, kind of help them out. She has to interpret for people who are, you know, who are trying to interact with her family. She spends her mornings out in the fishing boat. So by the time she gets to school, she smells like, you know, a fisherman. So there are all these things like outcasting her. And it's about this girl who's just trying to find herself and try to, you know, manage her allegiances to her family while also, you know, trying to find her own path in this world. And I think it's really heartwarming. I cannot wait till we can talk about it because I'm sure there's going to be a full review of this. But yeah, I can see why Apple paid $25 million for this movie because it's the sort of thing where you watch it and I don't know how you can't not love this movie because it's so sweet. The high school stuff isn't like super new or anything. Like it reminds me a lot of, I don't know. What was it? Almost 17 was the, there's so many, we've gone through so many high school movies recently. You know, I'm thinking of like, was the Greta Gerwig one as well. Names just escaping right now because it's very late and I've been watching
Greta Gerwig high school movie. Is that what you're referring? Lady Bird?
Yeah. Lady Bird. Like a lot of the like high school films seem like they start to deal with similar things, but like this outcast trying to survive the onslaught of high school with her one friend who is kind of quirky and you know, and she they're fighting for freedom. And this movie is basically that. But I think the world around it is so unique and so interesting. Has a great cast too. Marley Matlin plays her mother. So it's always great to see her in things too. And yeah, her entire family is played by deaf actors. And I think their relationship, seeing how they, you know, interact with her and sort of the pressure put on her as the only hearing person in that family, I think is really, it's interesting. It kind of reminds me of almost like the pressure like immigrant kids face, you know, when they have to translate for their parents and do a lot of work for them and their family's livelihood depends on them. It's an astounding movie. I think it's really heartwarming. So yeah, I can't wait until it's fully released so we can all talk about it.
Yeah, I imagine that's going to be a Slash Filmcast main review. So
yeah,
glad you enjoyed it. The movie's Coda. And it'll be on Apple TV Plus later this year. All right, gents, let's get to weekly plugs.
This is weird.
I wanted them to be super excited.
Rods, reels, and romance.
So good.
We're texting each other furiously.
I love that you did that.
Unsolicited. Let me tell you.
I think in a way,
it takes a lot to get us to furiously text.
So good.
Unsolicited.
Dot, all over the place.
So good.
So good.
Let the internet have its way.
I forgot how...
That was so much better. That one. That was so much better.
I forgot how completely incomprehensible that is.
It's so much better.
It's a little more inclusive than the other one, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay, they're both great, guys, okay? They're created by different people.
I just feel like one works a little better. That's all.
Yeah.
They're both great. Noah Ross did a great job with the original theme, and I think it was Thomas Medina that did the remix. Weekly plugs, the part of the show each week where we plug something we've been in that we recommend or something that we haven't been in that we recommend. This week, I want to plug an interview I did. I had a chance to chat with Ryan Broderick, a journalist who covers internet culture. We talked about Wall Street bets and a bunch of other random stuff that happened on the internet over the course of the last 10 years. So check that out. It's a conversation over at Culturally Relevant. And the internet's a really weird place. And I think Ryan Broderick used to write one of my favorite features over at BuzzFeed. Mm-hmm. Called like the worst things on the internet. If you guys ever read this thing, The Worst Things on the Internet?
Absolutely.
Every year they would publish this thing called The 50 Worst Things on the Internet in the year, 2019 or whatever the heck. And if you look at it, it's just so horrifying, guys. It's just so horrifying.
Listen, I'm on the internet all day, every day. I know. I feel it.
There was some way to know based on the title.
Like, I'm gonna, this is the one from 2019, okay? And I'm not gonna, I can't really read it to you because it's mostly images. But number 8 on the list is something called This Cooking Tutorial. And basically, I'm just gonna describe what it is. Somebody pouring Gatorade into a pot, putting cauliflower into it, cooking it until the cauliflower is green, and then serving it with bacon and eggs.
Green cauliflower and ham.
Yeah.
But Gatorade flavored. Anyway.
It's healthy. So, it's healthy because it's cauliflower.
So that was my conversation. I talked with Ryan Broderick about internet culture, Wall Street bets, GameStop, and a bunch of other cool stuff. Check that out at Culturally Relevant. Devendra, your weekly plug.
We did 2 episodes of the Engadget podcast this week. We did one with my managing editor, Terrence O'Brien, where we both talk about the movies we saw. So it's a lot of the things we've already talked about here, but also we dive into the VR experiences and, what it was like walking around and talking to people in VR in Sundance. And that was pretty wild. And also I chatted with Rodney Asher, the director of A Glitch in the Matrix. And,
nice.
And Natalia Almada, the director of Users. Actually, I should have put Glitch in the Matrix up in this thing too. But maybe next week when you guys get to see it, we could chat about that. Yeah.
Let's, I missed some stuff in the, what we've been watching, I realized. So maybe let's do that in the After Dark.
Sure.
I just realized as we were wrapping up what we've been watching, there's a couple things. So let's talk about Glitch in the Matrix. Let's talk about, I watched the Britney documentary. So let's talk about that as well.
Yeah. We had a good chat. So if you want to know what makes Rodney Asher tick, be sure to subscribe to the Engadget podcast.
Jeff Cannata, your weekly plug.
It's almost Valentine's Day, fellas. It's almost Valentine's Day, and you do not want to let your loved one down, do you? Well, I'm here to save the day. Save the day for you. If you've waited to the last minute, if you don't know what to get, there is nothing that your loved one will value more than a specially crafted, personalized limerick. That's right. Limericks at cameo.com/Jeff Cannata, delivered by yours truly, written by yours truly. You can have a finely crafted, beautiful keepsake that you'll cherish forever. A limerick. Nothing says I love you more. Nothing says I rhyme with you better than a limerick.
Nailed it, Jeff. Nailed it, Jeff.
Cameo.com/Jeff Cannata. Get those limericks in. Get those requests in. It's great for any occasion, but especially Valentine's Day.
Those are our weekly plugs for this week. We want to thank people who've donated to the Slash Filmcast as well during this time. People haven't really been donating that much because most of them have been heading over to our Patreon over at patreon.com /film podcast.
And thank you.
And that's great.
We love that.
We encourage that. But every once in a while, we'll still get a donation over at paypal.me/filmcast. So we want to give a big shout out to Michael Riley, who donated recently. Thank you so much for your support. And also got this message from Emily Toy, who asked about a quick Valentine's Day shout out to her husband, Tim Toy, who's been wonderful over the past year at helping their two girls while working from home. Happy Valentine's Day, Tim Toy.
Yay, Tim.
Those are our shout outs for this week. And those are our weekly plugs.
Let me jump in here and tell you that today we are welcoming a new sponsor to the show. Welcome, IP Vanish. What is IP Vanish? Well, IP Vanish is a virtual private network, a VPN for short. A VPN is a super important tool that helps you safely browse the internet. You can use a VPN on your computers, on your tablets, on your phones, even things like your Fire Stick when you're streaming media. And when you use a VPN, all your data is encrypted. What you're reading, what you're searching, what you're watching, whatever it is you're doing. And IP Vanish is just $3.49 a month. For just $3.49 a month or $27.99 a year, you can help protect your online privacy and security. Here's everything you get with IP Vanish. Anonymous IP addresses, that means your personal IP address can't be tracked by anyone on the web. You can circumvent any online censorship. IP Vanish has more than 1,500 servers in over 70 locations. You can get protection when using public Wi-Fi. Remember, with IP Vanish, all your data is encrypted, so no one can snoop on what you're doing. So go to ipvanish.com/filmcast and claim your 65% savings. They have plans that start at just $3.49 a month or $27.99 a year. This is the time to sign up. With our discount and their current promotional offerings, you can get a VPN for 65% off their usual offering. IP Vanish is the best of the best, even rating 4.7 out of 5 on Trustpilot, and that's with more than 6,000 reviews. Show these guys some love. Remember, it's ipvanish.com/filmcast to get the deal and start protecting yourself online. ipvanish.com/filmcast.
Let's get to our review of The Dig.
Should we take a look at them then?
Right. Things like this are usually done through museums.
Yes, but with the war coming, they couldn't embark upon any new ventures.
Well, I've been on digs since I was old enough to hold a trowel. My father taught me.
What are they?
We're standing in someone's graveyard, I reckon. Viking? Well, maybe older.
Mr. Brown is an archaeologist.
Well, I'm an excavator.
You've come to dig up the mounds.
So you think there's something beneath?
Who are those men?
They're from the museum.
Ye gods!
Mrs. Pretty, I think you'd better come and see.
That was from the trailer for The Dig, the newest film by director Simon Stone. I'm going to read the plot summary from IMDb. An archaeologist embarks on the historically important excavation of Sutton Hoo in 1938.
Sutton Hoo?
Sutton Hoo.
Sorry.
Sutton Hoo. I'm going to let that one go, Jeff.
Okay.
Let that one go. Okay. Devinder Hardwar, this is a movie about some people digging a hole in some guy's backyard, or someone's backyard,
yeah.
I should say.
Yeah.
Which is not does not sound like a riveting premise for a movie. So my question for you is, did this movie make that premise into something that you found interesting?
Oh, absolutely. I adore this movie. I think, yeah, describing it does seem like one of those things like, I want you guys to watch a period piece, you know, a period piece set in the precipice to World War II, but not actually involved in war, you know, like we're kind of on the outskirts of it, you know, starring some classic actors like Ralph Fiennes and Carey Mulligan. But, you know, they're going to be digging a hole in the dirt. Please watch my movie. I think describing it is tough, but I think this movie does a great job of The dig is about so much, right? Because I was vaguely aware of the Sutton Hoo excavation, kind of what they found. It was something that always kind of interested me. But also this idea, right, of finding something that is potentially over 1,000 years old, you know, and how that connects you to history in a way. I don't know if you guys have had an experience like... I don't know, just encountering something that is just supremely old. Like my one thing, right, is when I was in Barcelona, I've traveled a couple times for business trips, and that's the only place. Actually, no, I had to go to Germany at some point too. But Barcelona, they have the special exhibition of one of the Roman columns or a couple Roman columns, and it is just this thing in old Barcelona that's surrounded by apartment buildings. But you can sit there next to it and look at this thing that is just so old and feel yourself and your relationship to history, you know, even though there are people just living in apartments on the other side of these Roman columns. It's really weird. This movie kind of gave me that experience of kind of unearthing history. It's about these people trying to figure out their connections to it, but also what, you know, the things you leave behind, what that means for the future too. Like, this is a movie that is deeply existential. It's about people who are, they have uncertain futures ahead, and in one case, like, not much of a long future either, but they want to leave their lasting impact on the world, and they do this by unearthing something that's been around forever. So it is a movie that really deals with the nature of time and of what we bring to the world and what we leave behind. And I found that all really, really fascinating, and great performances all around too. Like, a, you know, it's Ralph Fiennes. He can, I feel like Ralph Fiennes could do a role like this in his sleep, but it is really also great to see Carey Mulligan, you know, back in another.
Unrecognizable from her role in Promising Young Woman, which we just reviewed.
Jarring. Yeah. It's jarring to see her going from that movie to this, where I think they kind of aged her up a little too, because I had read some interviews where, like, technically this character should be like 50 years old. I don't think that really hurts the movie, and the relationship she has with Ralph Fiennes' character is it's sort of like indefinable, right? It's not really romantic. They just have a connection around this discovery into the past. But I think she is phenomenal, and you know, I was just really more into this movie than I expected. You know, it's a movie about digging up the earth. The title is very descriptive there, but
great title.
It's about so much more. Yeah, good title.
Jeff Cannata, thoughts on The Dig?
Well, Dave, I guess you could say my thoughts on The Dig are best summed up in the form of a limerick.
Huh. All right.
You can get your own at cameo.com/Jeff Cannata. It can be satisfying to dig up what's underlying, and in this case, it means we face the truth of death and dying.
Nice. Nicely done. That one made me think a little bit, Jeff.
Yeah. Well, I try to throw a thinker in every once in a while, you know?
Nice.
Are you going to transition to the MASH theme song now? Like, that's what it feels like you're going.
Yeah. I basically agree 100% with everything that Devinder just said. It is a movie that completely took me by surprise in how engrossing it is. Mm-hmm. It is wonderful performances. I've said many times on this show over the years that there's a part of me that thinks, like, the only topic that's even worth contemplating in art, in a sense, is time. Like, that's the thing we're, like, reckoning with, is that we're all on this timeline and we're all going to die. And what does it mean? And why all art at a certain level is just dealing with that, you know? And I love movies that deal with it directly. And it is there. It deals with it metaphorically. It deals with it directly. It deals with it on a number of levels and through the lens of a number of characters. I can't think of another movie offhand that starts about two people and then sort of shifts halfway through and sidelines those people to a certain extent and, like, focuses on other people. And it kind of does that almost subtly and actually very skillfully, to the point where I didn't feel this jarring shift. It just, like, it just expands. It's like the world just grows a bit. And we are now talking about a larger group of people. And these people are also fascinating. And they're also dealing with the same kinds of issues, but in a very different way. The one thing that I will add that Devendra didn't mention is this movie is shot mm-hmm. absolutely beautifully. It's David Lean movie.
It looks like it's very Terrence Malick to me, just like the elliptical editing and everything too. Yeah,
I agree. Terrence Malick, a lot of handheld, following, like chasing after people with the camera.
But also these shots where like a David Lean movie where the characters are at the very bottom of the frame and like 2/3 of it is sky.
Yeah.
You know, it's these incredible vistas where the movie feels huge and gorgeous, and the lighting is spectacular. I mean, it is a sumptuous movie in so many ways, and about, you know, people digging stuff up in the mm-hmm. backyard. It makes the scope and scale feel much larger than it really is, mm-hmm. and how much all of these characters are invested in these moments. It does feel like this monumental activity. And as Devendra pointed out so well, I couldn't help but feel connected to history. It makes you reckon with how we are connected to our humanity, how people have come before us and will come after us. And we are just this blip moment in time. And we are a part of this tapestry, this continuation of the human experience. And those themes, that sort of larger than life feeling of we are just this tiny little breath in a longer expression, I found it to be really powerful and moving and just a complete surprise of a film. I loved The Dig.
Awesome. I'm really glad you guys both enjoyed it. I echo the same thoughts. This is a movie where I started watching this movie and I was thinking to myself, is this the whole thing? Them digging the hole? Is this going to be the whole thing?
It's in the title. Come on.
I'm like, I knew there was going to be a dig, but is this the whole movie? And in fact, it kind of, as you mentioned, Jeff, it starts with these kind of two characters played by Ralph Fiennes and Cara Mulligan. And it kind of like spirals out from there, right? You see like more of the people that come in and interact with their lives. And you learn more about the characters and their history. One of the things I really appreciate about this movie that I don't think you guys mentioned is that something I appreciate about the film, everything you guys said, I love it and I think it's all true. And I think that the movie is saying all that stuff. In addition to that, I think one of the things that the movie is trying to say is about that the movie conveys is the satisfaction of doing a job well, which is kind of personified in the role of Ralph Fiennes, right? And like,
beautiful, yeah.
This idea of, hey, he's kind of like, he reminds me of a Harry Stamper, played by Bruce Willis in Armageddon, whose job it is to like dig holes well. And I'm like,
well, you know what? It's basically the same movie. It's basically the same movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're both about people who need to dig things. And
yes.
And really,
yes.
I should have done a Boom Goes the Dynamite about the two.
You should have. Yeah.
I just tried thinking of it right now.
On the verge of a cataclysmic,
cataclysmic
global event.
Yeah, in which a guy needs to dig a hole, you know, in order to achieve salvation. But enough about Michael Bay's Armageddon. Okay. So I really enjoyed it. I thought the performance was great.
A child takes a bike and rides off out of passion. I don't know. Yeah. Sorry.
it shows a young couple having sex in the sunset, you know?
Yeah. Right before one of them has to go off and do something terrifying.
Yeah. There you go. Anyway.
Right after they, yeah.
Missed opportunity, Jeff. Missed opportunity. Anyway.
It really is.
Really enjoyed the film. Guys, why don't we get the spoilers for The Dig starting right now.
Now you're looking for the secret.
You're going to see this coming.
No.
But you won't find it because, of course,
you're not going to see this coming.
You're not really looking.
I have been puzzling over how it works.
You don't really want to work it out.
Who's in the box?
I have been dying to tell you.
I want to tell you my secret.
You want to be fooled.
So one of the things that was obvious, like for me, it was very unpredictable. Like it was, I did not see this whole other romance happening. Also, you mentioned the relationship between Carey Mulligan's character and Ralph Fiennes' character. I agree with you, Devendra, that they kind of tried to age her up. Like she felt like she was supposed to be in her 40s. Carey Mulligan in real life
Still felt weird to me.
Yeah.
Still felt weird. Yeah, because at the beginning, like, they tease this, like, she kind of wants him to come to dinner, and it feels like she's really romantically interested in him.
She's getting, like, dolled up and everything
for him.
Curious.
Right? Yeah, she's curious about him. Like, you know, yeah, I get it.
Yeah, and then her wife is, his wife is, like, the best lady ever. She's super nice and supportive and awesome.
Yeah.
And you're like, why does this movie want me to feel about this, this relationship?
I was just like, what is happening? Who am I supposed to be rooting for here?
Yeah, adult platonic relationships are pretty complex sometimes. Yeah.
One might think. But then there's the Lily James character, right? And, like, which, by the way, apparently that whole thing... This thing is based off of a true story, but that whole thing was fabricated, as far as I can recall, like that whole love interest thing.
Yeah, it feels like it was written for a war movie, so yes, I totally believe that.
Yeah, Peggy Pigott, and also, by the way, Ben Chaplin.
Peggy Pigott. Top 10 all-time movie name, Peggy Pigott.
Yeah, indeed. Ben Chaplin plays her husband, Ben, Stuart, and he was one of the main characters in Mad Dogs. The Amazon original series, if you guys remember that.
Oh, such a great Amazon original series. What, are they making a second season to that?
No, it's been like 10 years.
Oh, they put those dogs down, Jeff.
That was so good, you guys.
Yeah, it was good. It was good. Anyway, so it did feel, as you mentioned, you could kind of see that this movie is leaning into the war movie cliches there, right? With the Peggy Pigott and the whole falling in love thing.
He's going off to war. Like, it's their last night together. He just pulls a body out of the river. Like, oh, man.
I will say, here's what I say I enjoyed about the movie is whenever I started kind of getting bored, like even when I started... something wild would happen that I could not have foreseen happening.
The moment he gets caved in, the first 20 minutes of the movie where he's like, it's like, holy shit!
Great example.
Kill Ralph Fiennes in this movie?
Yeah, I was like, but the movie's called The Dig. How is he going to do The Dig if Ralph Fiennes is there?
Yeah.
So that was one thing. Another thing is everyone's just chilling, having a good time. All of a sudden, a scene from Dunkirk happens where like a plane kind of like, falls out of the sky and they have to save him. I'm just like, holy shit, like, wow. And that's something that I appreciate about the film is like it would just throw something out of nowhere at you whenever you might have even thought about getting bored. So I thought the pacing for a movie that's like a period drama was really good. I enjoyed it. I never got bored. Anything you guys have to any thoughts about the ending,
we can talk about the ending, but one of the things that just gave me anxiety watching this movie is every time there would be a thunderstorm and he would attempt to put canvas over the dig site. I was like, I just the idea of the futility of that, it just made me so anxious and like it's already ruined, man. What do you, it's like, you know, pushing a boulder up a
hill.
It's
just a little wet. It's still good. It's still good. Right.
That's rough. I brought up the like Terrence Malick kind of influence before. I definitely see the David Lean stuff, but for me, the way this movie is edited too, right, where conversations would begin and it would be showing you a scene from the future or the past and kind of go backwards and forwards at times too. I found that really interesting. And there's a lot of just wide angle lenses too, because first of all, you need that to kind of shoot a giant, you know, excavation, but they use that for a lot of the dialogue scenes too. So everybody feels small in it. Yeah. Not also against the sky, but also by the very way they're being shot, with the lens, everything feels distorted in a way. And I dug that. Like clearly I've never heard of Simon Stone before, but you can clearly, he's wearing his influences on his sleeve, but I think doing really great work with that. He's not just copying these guys. Like I think he's using those tools really well.
Yeah. Honestly, you mentioned it.
Honestly, it reminded me of Steven Soderbergh, because he does that thing with where he has characters talking, but you don't see their mouths moving. So he's like editing the dialogue over a separate scene of them just hanging out.
Yeah,
I actually went and watched Out of Sight after I watched this movie because it was so evocative of a filmmaking technique. It's almost like you're conveying twice as much or 1.5 times the amount of information as you normally would, because you're getting the dialogue, but you're also getting those characters in a separate environment and a context. And you kind of seeing how they behave around each other while you're getting the exposition.
Yep.
I thought it really worked for this movie. Maybe a little bit overused, because it got a little bit to the point where I was like, are they moving their lips? Like, I don't understand what's happening. Are we watching the thing that's that? You know, like, I was thinking that towards the end of the movie, but overall, I thought it really worked. Jeff, go ahead.
You said it better than I would have. I was going to say much of the same. And I differ from you. I never got to the point where I thought it was overused. I thought it was really effective throughout. And it's kind of a lovely, it gave it a lovely sort of abstraction almost of this tale that was displaced in time too. You know, we're talking about time, we're talking about history, we're talking about what perseveres through time, through history. And these words are sort of almost ghostly, right? They're hovering there above other scenes. Mm. And
yeah,
I loved that effect. I thought it was really effective.
Mm-hmm. I saw this movie after Malcolm and Marie, by the way, and you know, you can really see the effective way to convey certain kinds of conversations, but also there's a lot of communication just through visuals and just through acting in this movie, right? Of where people aren't saying anything, but the way they look at each other. I really think about Ralph Fiennes' wife and like what, you know, what she was like, well, he's in love with this work and we may not have the most money in the world, but he seems very fulfilled by what he does. But I don't know what she thought of, like, you know, Carey Mulligan's character. Like, I wish that maybe had even been explored a little more, but there's like some understanding there you could see. It's why she never wants to like spend the night or.
I love that.
Yeah.
She seems wholly unthreatened and he keeps like, what, you want to spend the night? And she's like, I'll wait till you get home. You know,
I'll do something interesting.
It's such a power move of like, you want me to spend the night, huh? Well, maybe you should come home when you're ready to spend the night with me. You know, yeah. So it's such a power move. I loved her. I thought she was awesome.
Mm-hmm. She's great. Yeah.
And that whole sequence when the little boy goes out to the, you know, rides out, then like how they handled that as a couple. I just thought it's just so lovely. You know, it just feels like.
Well, I was going to give a shout out to that boy actor. Archie Barnes. You know, usually kid actors, you know, really irritate me. I'm just going to put that out there. And a child actor usually needs to surmount a high bar in order to not irritate me.
Well, only because they're human beings and human beings irritate you, Dave.
I mean, you're not wrong. But this kid was great. And, you know, a couple scenes that were like really strong. There was a scene where he felt like he was responsible for his mom's sickness. And then the last scene when they're kind of lying in the boat and, you know, looking off into the stars. And it's just, that's where they're really gunning for those heartstrings, right?
Yeah.
And I think what's implied by the end of the film is that Carey Mulligan's character has died. Yes. Like that's kind of what I got from it. Cause he kind of gets into this car and like waves to Ralph Fiennes. And I think the idea is that she's dead.
Yeah, everybody's in black standing up there. And you feel like, well, there is going to be another dig, you know, or a grave. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So, but I thought he was great and really sold that role. So he did a great job. Wanted to give him a shout out as well. All right. Any other thoughts on The Dig? Anything else we want to highlight about this movie?
It's too bad. I would love to have seen this movie on the big screen. I mean, in my home theater is pretty darn good and I got to see it. You know, I thought it was beautiful on my big screen TV, but this is really a large format movie. It's about a small thing, but it feels like a big screen experience. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm.
Absolutely. It's also one of those movies, right, where that is so, I miss sort of just being like emotionally devastated in a giant theater, right? Yeah, like, and just like, hey, you're just surrounded by strangers, but you don't know each other, but you're all kind of just going through this thing together. And this movie made me miss that connection as well.
I'll tell you a couple of other quick, mention another couple of quick things. One is that I started watching this with my wife and she said, oh yeah, she's very into British things. And we were watching it. She's like, oh yeah, you know, this kind of stuff happens all the time where they like dig up someone's backyard and try to look for stuff.
Turns out there's a lot of history there. Yeah.
And then she said, then later on after she did some reading, she's like, oh, what she didn't fully understand was this movie and the events depicted are the reason why that happens.
Yes. Basically. Yes.
this is apparently like a really big deal in UK history, you know, and so it's not necessarily something that like we in the States would know about, but it's something that apparently a lot of people, it's relatively widely known over there. So wanted to shout that out.
But it's so wild that they were just like giant mounds. Mm-hmm. In, you know,
sure,
that
there's
like
something there, right?
A thousand year old mound in my backyard. You know, it's pretty wild.
Yeah, yeah. It just opened all this possibility of what could possibly be there. But I do want to just close by saying, I ultimately, right, what the movie wants you to reflect on is it's a movie about unearthing part of the past, but at the same time, it's also about like what we leave behind. Right. And it's about like, who are the people you'll impact? Like, ultimately, at the end of the day, we are lucky if, you know, 5,000 years from now, someone's going to find, you know, Jeff Kanata's gold shoulder clasp, you know, like in buried somewhere. Right.
You know,
like,
about that?
Yeah, I know. But like, that's the thing is like, we'll be lucky if there's going to be even that much of a trace of us left. And so given that that's the case, like what is it that we do leave behind? Like, what will your legacy be?
How else do I keep my shoulder connected?
I know, it's so true. These are the things that the movie, forces you to ask, or wants you to ask. And I think it does a good job of prompting it. So anyway, those are our thoughts on The Dig, which is a pretty good film. Let's wrap up. Stay tuned to hear what we'll be discussing next week. In the meantime, you can find more episodes of this podcast at slashfilmcast.com. Email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Our theme song comes from adamwarrock.com. Our spoiler bumper comes from YouTuber Kyle Hillinger. Our weekly plugs music comes from Noah Ross and Thomas Medina, both of whom did an awesome job with the remix and the original song. This episode was edited by Beatty Zhang. So stay tuned for the After Dark. If you're at patreon.com/filmpodcast, we'll be discussing Malcolm and Marie, plus a couple of other things we missed during what we've been watching. And next week, we'll be reviewing Judas and the Black Messiah, which is going to be debuting over on HBO Max. This is the second film that's going to be released this year that is simultaneously on HBO Max and also in theaters.
But this one is good.
Yeah. I have a feeling this has the potential to be the first great film of 2021.
Oh, buddy.
So I am really excited to talk about it with you all next week on the Slash Filmcast. Again, thanks to our patrons over at patreon.com/filmpodcast for making this podcast possible. Thanks to all of our sponsors. Thank you for listening. We'll see you later. We watch the movies, play side tracks for the good, side bad. It's the Slash Filmcast.